and gentlemen, good morning and welcome to The Call. This is your coffee for the mind, the call to get your mind moving in the right direction, to get the right seeds planted so that we can grow within our lives, happiness, health, wealth, abundance, all of the wonderful things that we have at our fingertips available to us if we will but just think and learn some principles, some laws. Excited to be here. Today, we're going to finish out chapter 2, which is chapter on faith. We've just learned how to cultivate faith through auto-suggestion, very powerful principle. We also learned that we should, in addition to going through the major definite purpose and the self-confidence formula on a daily basis, morning and night, Denise pointed out something that has been very powerful for me, and I know has been very powerful for everyone who's doing it. Think about your thinking. So not only do your major definite purpose and your self-confidence formula morning and night, but throughout the day, think about your thinking. Watch your thoughts. Ask yourself, what am I thinking about? And catch yourself when those negative thoughts may happen to slip into your mind. That's a powerful exercise that I encourage us all to continue on. Now, today, Bill is going to share with us a story entitled A Pretty After-Dinner Speech for $1 Billion, and I absolutely love this story because it illustrates several very powerful principles that we'll want to pay attention to and see if we can extrapolate. But one that right off the bat is that money definitely begins in an idea. An idea can turn into hundreds, thousands, millions, and yes, even billions of dollars. So, Bill, Mr. Bill Hartraft, are you on the line this morning?
Good morning, Paul. Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Glad I'm back. Boy, am I glad I'm back. I'm not feeling well Friday morning. I really hustled to get back for the call, too, but sorry, folks, I couldn't make it. Yeah, it's funny, Paul, when I went reading through all that stuff, I had no idea you went through so much on Friday, so I did not read this in advance, so bear with me, even though I read it many years ago. This is titled A Pretty After-Dinner Speech for $1 Billion. That's B with billion. When on the evening of December 12th, 1900, some 80 of the nation's financial nobility gathered in the banquet hall, that's spelled wrong, hall of the University Club on Fifth Avenue, to honor a young man from the West Coast. Not half a dozen of the guests realized they were to witness the most significant episode in American industrial history. J. Edward Simmons and Charles Stuart Smith, their hearts full of gratitude for the lavish hospitality bestowed on them by Charles Schwab during a recent visit to Pittsburgh, had arranged the dinner to introduce the 38-year-old steel man to Eastern Banking Society, but they didn't expect him to stampede the convention. They warned him, in fact, that the bosoms within New York stuffed shirts would not be responsive to oratory, and that if he didn't want to bore the Stillmans and Harrimans and Vanderbilts, he had better limit himself to 15 or 20 minutes of polite vaporings and let it go at that. Even John Pierpont Morgan, sitting on the right-hand side of Schwab, as became his imperial dignity, intended to grace the banquet table with his presence only briefly. And so far as the press and public were concerned, the whole affair was of so little moment that no mention of it found its way into the print the next day. So the two hosts and their distinguished guests ate their way through the usual 7 or 8 courses. There was little conversation, and what there was of it was restrained. Few of the bankers and brokers had met Schwab, whose career had flowered along the banks of the Monongahela, wherever that is, and none knew him well. But before the evening was over, they and, boy, the English here is not very good, they and with them, Money Master Morgan, were to be swept off their feet, and a $1 billion baby. The United States Steel Corporation was to be conceived. It is perhaps unfortunate for the sake of history that no record of Charlie Schwab's speech at the dinner was ever made. He repeated some parts of it at a later date during a similar meeting to Chicago bankers. And still later, when the government brought suit to dissolve the Steel Trust, he gave his own version from the witness stand of the remarks that stimulated Morgan into a frenzy of financial activity. It is probable, however, that it was a homely speech, somewhat ungrammatical, for the niceties of language never bothered Schwab, full of epigram and threaded with wit. But aside from that, it had a galvanic force and effect upon the $5 billion of estimated capital that was represented by the dinners. After it was over, the gathering was still under its spell. Although Schwab had talked for 90 minutes, Morgan led the orator to a recessed window where, dangling their legs from the high, uncomfortable seats, they talked for an hour or more. The magic of the Schwab personality had been turned on, full force. But what was more important and lasting was the full-fledged, clear-cut program he laid down for the aggrandizement of Steele. Sorry, everybody, I couldn't read that. Many other men had tried to interest Morgan in slapping together a Steele trust after the pattern of the biscuit, wire and hoop, sugar, rubber, whiskey, oil, and chewing gum combinations. John Gates, the gambler, had urged it, but Morgan distrusted him. The Moore boys, Bill, Jim, Chicago stock jobbers who had glued together a matched trust and a cracker corporation, had urged it and failed. Albert Gary, the sanctimonious country lawyer, wanted to foster it, but he wasn't big enough to be impressive until Schwab's eloquence took J.P. Morgan to the heights from which he could visualize the solid results of the most daring financial undertaking ever conceived. The project was regarded as a delirious dream of easy money crackpots. The financial magnetism that began a generation ago to attract thousands of small and sometimes inefficiently managed companies into large and competition-crushing combinations had become operative in the steel world through the devices of that jovial business pirate, John W. Gates. Gates had already had formed the American Steel and Wire Company out of a chain of small concerns, and together with Morgan, had created the Federal Steel Company. The National Tube and American Bridge Companies were two more Morgan concerns, and the Moore brothers had forsaken the match and cookie business to form the American Group, Tin Plate, Steel Hoop, Sheet Steel, and the National Steel Company. But by the side of Andrew Carnegie's gigantic Vertical Trust, a trust owned and operated by 53 partners, whose other combinations were picayune. They might combine to their heart's content, but the whole lot of them couldn't make a dent in the Carnegie organization, and Morgan knew it. The eccentric old Scott knew it too. From the magnificent heights of Skibbo Castle, he had viewed, first with amusement and then with resentment, the attempts of Morgan's smaller companies to cut into his business. When the attempts became too bold, Carnegie's temper was translated into anger and retaliation. He decided to duplicate every mill owned by his rivals. Hitherto, he hadn't been interested in wire, pipe, hoops, or sheet. Instead, he was content to sell such companies the raw steel and let them work it into whatever shape they wanted. Now, with Schwab as his chief and able lieutenant, he planned to drive his enemies to the wall. So it was that, in the speech of Charles Schwab, Morgan saw the answer to his problem of combination. A trust without Carnegie, giant of them all, would be no trust at all. A plum pudding, as one writer said, without the plums. Schwab's speech on the night of December 12, 1900, undoubtedly carried the inference, though not the pledge, that the vast Carnegie enterprise could not be brought under the Morgan tent. He talked of the world future for steel, for reorganization, for efficiency, of specialization, of the scrapping of unsuccessful mills and concentration of effort on the flourishing properties of economies and the ore traffic of economies in overhead and administrative departments, of capturing foreign markets. More than that, he told the buccaneers among them wherein lay the errors of their customary piracy. Their purposes, he inferred, bad been to create monopolies, raise prices, and pay themselves fat dividends out of privilege. Schwab condemned the system in his heartiest manner. the short-sightedness of such a policy, he told his hearers, lay in the fact that it restricted the market in an area when everything cried for expansion. By cheapening the cost of steel, he argued, an ever-expanding market would be created. More uses for steel be devised, and a goodly portion of the world trade could be captured. Actually, though, he did not know it. Schwab was an apostle of modern mass production. So the dinner at the University Club came to an end. Morgan went home to think about Schwab's rosy predictions. Schwab went back to Pittsburgh to run the steel business for Wee Andrew Carnegie, while Gary and the rest went back to their stock tickers, to fiddle around in anticipation of the next move. It was not long coming. It took Morgan about 1 week to digest the feast of reason Schwab had placed before him. When he had assured himself that no financial indigestion was to result, he sent for Schwab and found that young man rather coy. Mr. Carnegie Schwab indicated might not like it if he found his trust company president had been flirting with the Emperor of Wall Street, the street upon which Carnegie was resolved never to tread. Then it was suggested by Mr. Gates, the go-between, that if Schwab happened to be in the Bellevue Hotel in Philadelphia, J.P. Morgan might also happen to be there. When Schwab arrived, however, Morgan was inconveniently ill at his home in New York, so the elder man's pressing invitation, Schwab went to New York and presented himself at the door of the financier's library. This is very difficult to read. Now, certain economic historians have professed the belief that from the beginning to the end of the drama, the stage was set by Andrew Carnegie, that the dinner to Schwab, the famous speech, the Sunday night conference between Schwab and the Money King, were events arranged by the canny Scott. The truth is exactly the opposite. When Schwab was called in to consummate the deal, he didn't even know whether the little boss, as Andrew was called, would so much as listen to an offer to sell, particularly to a group of men whom Andrew regarded as being endowed with something less than holiness. But Schwab did take into the conference with him his own handwriting, 6 sheets of copper plate figures representing to his mind the physical worth and the potential earning capacity of every steel company he regarded as an essential star in the new metal firmament. Four men pondered over these figures all night. The chief, of course, was Morgan, steadfast in his belief in the divine right of money. With him, his aristocratic partner, Robert Bacon, a scholar and a gentleman. The third was John W. Gates, whom Morgan scorned as a gambler and used as a tool. The fourth was Schwab, who knew more about the processes of making and selling steel than any whole group of men then living. Throughout the conference, the Pittsburgher's figures were never questioned. If he said, a company was worth so much, then it was worth that much and no more. He was insistent, too, upon including in the combination only those concerns he nominated. He had conceived a corporation in which there would be no duplication, not even to satisfy the greed of friends who wanted to upload their companies upon the broad Morgan shoulders. Thus, he left out, by design, a number of the larger concerns upon which the walruses and carpenters of Wall Street had cast hungry eyes. When dawn came, Morgan rose and straightened his back. Only one question remained. "Do you think you can persuade Andrew Carnegie to sell?" he asked. "I can try," said Schwab. "If you can get him to sell, I will undertake the matter," said Morgan. "So far, so good, but would Carnegie sell? How much would he demand?" Schwab thought about $320 million. "What would he take? What would he take payment in? Common or preferred stock? Bonds? Cash?" Nobody could raise a third of $1 billion in cash. There was a golf game in January on the frost-cracking heath of St. Andrew's Links in Westchester, with Andrew bundled up in sweaters against the cold, and Charlie talking volubly, as usual, to keep his spirits up. But no word of business was mentioned until the pair sat down in the cozy warmth of the Carnegie Cottage Then, with the same persuasiveness that had hypnotized 80 millionaires at the University Club, Schwab poured out the glittering promises of retirement and comfort of untold millions to satisfy the old man's social caprices. Carnegie capitulated and wrote a figure on a slip of paper, handed it to Schwab, and said, "All right, that's what we'll sell it for." The figure was approximately $400 million. And was reached by taking the $320 million mentioned by Schwab as a basic figure and adding it to $80 million to represent the increased capital value over the previous 2 years. Later on the deck of the transatlantic liner, the Scotsman said ruefully to Morgan, "I wish I'd asked for $100 million more. If you had asked for it, you'd have gotten it," Morgan told him cheerfully. Do you want me to stop there, Paul?
No, let's go ahead and finish it out. I think we've got just one more page.
Okay. There was an uproar, of course. A British correspondent cabled that the foreign steel world was appalled by the gigantic combination. President Hadley of Yale declared that unless trusts were regulated, the country might expect an emperor in Washington within the next 25 years. But that able stock manipulator, Keene, went at his work of shoving the new stock at the public so vigorously that all the excess water, estimated by some at nearly $600 million, was absorbing in a twinkling. So Carnegie had his millions, and the Morgan Syndicate had $62 million for all its trouble, and all the boys from Gates to Gary had their millions. The 38-year-old Schwab had his reward. He was made president of the new corporation and remained in control until 1930. The dramatic story of big business, which you have just finished, was included in this book because it is a perfect illustration of the method by which desire can be transmuted into its physical equivalent. I imagine some readers will question the statement that a mere intangible desire can be converted into its physical equivalent. Doubtless, some will say, you cannot convert nothing into something. The answer is in the story of the United States Steel. That giant organization was created in the mind of one man. The plan by which the organization was provided with the steel mills that gave it financial stability was created in the mind of the same man. His faith, his desire, his imagination, his persistence were the real ingredients that went into United States Steel. The steel mills and mechanical equipment acquired by the corporation after being brought into legal existence were incidental, but careful analysis will disclose the fact that the appraised value of the properties acquired by the corporation increased in value by an estimated $600 million by the mere transaction which consolidated them under one management. In other words, Charles M. Schwab's idea plus the faith, which he conveyed it to the minds of the Morgan, J.P. Morgan, and the others, was marketed for a profit of approximately $600 million, not an insignificant sum for a single idea. What happened to some of the men who took their share of the millions of dollars of profit made by this transaction is a matter with which we are not now concerned. The important feature of the astounding achievement is that it serves as an unquestionable evidence of the soundness of the philosophy described in this book, because this philosophy was the warp and the woof of the entire transaction. Moreover, the practicability and the philosophy has been established by the fact that the United States Steel Corporation prospered and became one of the richest and most powerful corporations in America, employing thousands of people, developing new uses for steel, and opening new markets, thus proving that the $600 million in profit which the Schwab idea produced was earned. Riches begin in the form of thought. The amount is limited only by the person in whose mind the thought is put into motion. Faith removes limitations. I'm going to read that again. Riches begin in the form of thought. We were just talking about thinking about our thoughts. The amount is limited only by the person in whose mind the thought is put into motion. Faith removes limitations. That's huge. Faith removes limitations. Remember this, when you're ready to bargain with life for whatever it is that you ask as your price for having passed this way, remember also that the man who created the United States Steel Corporation was practically unknown at the time. He was merely Andrew Carnegie's Man Friday until he gave birth to his famous idea. After that, he quickly rose to a position of power, fame, and riches. Paul?
Hey, Bill, thanks so much for reading that incredible story.
Very difficult to read.
It is. You know, it is a tough story to read. There's a lot of vocabulary, a lot of things that aren't too familiar to our day and age today.
Even mine.
But but you know, as Jim Rohn says, I always remember what Jim Rohn says. He says, you can't just read the easy stuff. You won't grow. You won't learn. You won't change. I sat down last night and started a new book called The Story of Philosophy by Will Durant, and I literally had to have my iPad out to look up words that this guy is using, and I just kept reminding myself, this is how you grow. This is how you grow.
I grew in that call.
Powerful story, though, you know, really, when you think about the principles contained in that story. You know, the question that comes to mind is, where do riches lie? You know, where are riches? Yeah. Are the riches located in the factories, in the steel, in the physical assets? And yeah, there's a part of it there, but you know what? All of that stuff, all the assets, all the equipment, all the materials in the hands of the wrong person, or in other words, in control of the wrong mind, are absolutely worthless. And on the other hand, nothing, somebody starting with zero assets or assets unorganized in the hands or in the mind of the right man or woman are literally worth untold millions. So this story, I love this story because it contains the idea that riches, as he stated and as you restated, riches begin in the form of thought. The amount is limited only by whom the person whose thought is put into motion, and faith removes limitation. Some principles that I extrapolated as you were going through that story, Bill. Obviously, number one, riches begin in the form of an idea. That whole idea of the combination of, you know, this mega steel trust began in the form of Charles Schwab. He had a plan, which, by the way, other men had plans kind of similar to this, but their plans were inferior. They weren't solid enough. They weren't well organized enough to inspire faith in the number of people that it needed to inspire faith so that things could come together. So an idea, a solid plan, and the other thing that I noticed was a mastermind. You know, multiple minds coming together to perfect the plan. Although it didn't have to be perfect, but to make it as perfect as possible before moving forward. So having an idea, having a plan, masterminding with people who can help you refine your ideas and sharpen them, all things that each one of us on this call have total and complete access to, if we will but think and use our mind. So those are just a couple of things that I noticed, Bill. Anything you want to add before we open up the lines here?
Well, I'll just say this, that brings back something really powerful. My mother told me about my grandfather, her father, growing up. As I was, you know, as we age, we tend to seek out information about our backgrounds, and since I was the youngest of four children, I didn't know my grandfather and grandmother as well as my siblings. And one thing my mother told me about my grandfather, which is sort of what I did, I was a stockbroker when I first started out in business, so you'd think that would have been an easy read for me, but it wasn't, as we found out. One thing my grandfather did, which was pretty cool, is that he created a business all unto himself. Yes, he was a co-founder of one of the biggest brokerage firms in New York City, and a self-made millionaire, and without going to college, I might add. And what he did is he did exactly this. He put ideas and he into other companies' heads and said, you know, your company will thrive if you put this company and merge this company with your company. And that's what he did. He created mergers and he pulled companies together so they'd thrive even better. And wow, that's really powerful when you think about this story. That's what my grandfather did. While I listened to you talk, Paul, I started to think, how does this apply to my life? And oh my God, it applies to my grandfather. That's what he did. He created mergers and he put ideas and thoughts into other companies' heads and said, look, you really want to take off and you really want to thrive. You need to put this company with this company and you'll take off. Paul?
Absolutely, an idea, you know, planting those ideas, and it's just absolutely amazing. It staggers me every time I think about this beautiful truth that in a seedling of an idea can form oak trees of financial wealth, incredible health, happiness, prosperity. All of this begins in the form of an idea, and we see this illustrated in story after story after story. And the more stories we hear, the more times we hear a story, read a story, and can see this truth demonstrated, the more that truth is embedded within our subconscious minds, and the more that we are empowered to know that we have access to the same power that these people had access to in achieving this incredible wealth. So, Bill, you did a great job. Thank you so much for going through that with us. And I'd love to open up the lines.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Paul.
Okay, you may unmute your line by pressing *6. Love to hear from anyone and everyone who has comments or questions or would like to discuss what we've gone over today.
Oh, fantastic. I'll take a shot at this morning. I was so excited to hear you guys this morning. I'm out here on the West Coast. Hey, listen, this is one of my favorite stories, and with the book Think and Grow Rich and The Companion, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Now, these books, both of these were written in an awesome time. I think probably the greatest people of our times were from this era, okay? And I want to point out one thing about this whole statement about Charlie Schwab and that he knew more about steel than anybody else, because what he said to Dale Carnegie, the guy who wrote this book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and I thought it was awesome to share. Now, we know that Charlie Schwab, from reading that book, was one of the first guy in the United States to earn $1 million working for a corporation. And he said why Andrew Carnegie promoted him to the top guy in the company was because of his ability to show appreciation and arouse encouragement in the people that was working for him. And that was that's the thing that I really got out of this whole talk about Andrew Carnegie, because if you look back, all these other guys were there trying to win over you know, with the old guy, you know, Andrew Carnegie, the Scottish, you know, and none of them could, but it was his ability to arouse enthusiasm in people and just to uplift people that made Charlie Schwab one of the number one guys in business and the ability to deal with people. And so we're in the people business. I actually don't care what business you're in if you really look at it. Every business deals with people. If a business is going south, somebody comes in and they rearrange management, they do. They fire the people and bring new people in. Everything is people. Everything, you know, people use products. That's without products and salesmen out there and what we do, nothing goes anywhere. People use products. So I want to thank Charlie Schwab, and I want to thank you guys on here tonight, this morning, to bring this topic out, and that's what I got to say this morning. Thank you.
Rick, thank you. Fabulous comments. Really great addition to our discussion here this morning as we're studying this incredible story. Appreciate you, man.
Appreciate you.
Anyone else? The lines are open. They are crisp and clear here in Idaho this morning. Would love to hear anyone else step out. Let's hear from you. All right.
Paul,
again,
there was one thing, Paul. Was one thing I wanted to add. I know we've gone over this before, but in my process of trying to find what you wanted me to read this morning, I just wanted to read this poem one more time because I thought, wow, this is so profound, and it's true to even what we are talking about here today. It's a poem written in this book, and it's in this chapter as well. If you think you are beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you like to win, but you think you can't, it is almost certain you won't. If you think you'll lose, you're lost. For out of the world we find, success begins with a fellow's will. It's all in the state of mind. If you think you are outclassed, you are. You've got to think high to rise. You've got to be sure of yourself before you can ever win a prize. Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or faster man, but soon or late, the man who wins is the man who thinks he can. So your thinking, your thought, that's what we started the call off today with, Paul, and thanks to Denise, and I've been doing that. And that is so powerful, and I just wanted to leave everybody with that because I read that a couple of times while I was looking for the story today, and I thought, wow, that's really powerful. I did want to spend a second and read that to everybody. So, Paul?
Absolutely. Couldn't think of a better way to end the call, Bill. Thanks for sharing that. Everyone, let's get out there. Let's make it a great day. Believe in yourself. Believe in your ideas, believe in your plans, and there is absolutely nothing that you cannot achieve with good ideas, good plans, faith in yourself, and the understanding that you can learn from each temporary setback and move forward in a better way, a more powerful way, and have less and less temporary setback come into your life as you get better, as you grow, as you improve. And that's what we're doing here in this beautiful life. We're learning, we're growing, we're understanding new ideas, and we're supporting each other. I thank each of you for being on the call and being a valuable part of this community that we're creating daily, each morning. So let us go out there and apply what we've learned. Let's take action. Let's move forward with faith. Let us be people of vision, of power, of passion, of purpose. And let's make the world a better place today, my friends. Love you. Thank you again for being on the call. And we'll see you back here tomorrow morning on the Think and Grow Rich call. Bill, also thank you as always. Really appreciate you, my friend.
Thank you, Paul. God bless everybody.